He was taking kickbacks from the animal dealers, Craig said, so that we were ordered to leave orphans that were so young they only had a 50-50 chance of survival. So that we looked for herds with high percentages of small calves. He was taking bribes from the dealers.
Who?
Not Tompkins, the head warden, Jonathan exclaimed.
Yes, Tompkins.
Craig stood up and took both their glasses to refill.
Have you got proof?
No, of course I haven't, Craig replied irritably. If I had, I would have taken it straight to the minister.
So you refuse to cow?
Craig flopped back in the chair, long bare legs sprawled and hair hanging in his eyes.
And that's not all. They're stealing the ivory from the cull. We're supposed to leave the big bulls, but Tompkins ordered us to hit anything with good ivory, and the tusks just disappear.
No proof of that either, I suppose, Jonathan asked dryly.
I saw the helicopter making the pickup.
And you got the registration letters?
They were masked, Craig shook his head. But it was a military machine. It's organized.
So you punched Tompkins?
It was beautiful, said Craig dreamily. He was on his hands and knees trying to pick up his teeth that were scattered all over the floor of his office. I never worked out what he was going to do with them.
Craig, my boy, what did you hope to achieve? Do you think it'll stop them, even if your suspicions are correct?
No, but it made me feel a lot better. Those elephants are almost human. I became pretty fond of them.
They were both silent for a while, and then Jonathan sighed.
How many jobs is that now, Craig?
I wasn't keeping score, Bahu.
I cannot believe that anybody with Ballantine blood in his veins is totally lacking in either talent or ambition. Christ, boy, we Ballantines are winners. Look at Douglas, look at Roland.
I'm a Mellow, only half a Ballantine.
Yes, I suppose that accounts for it. Your grandfather frittered away his share in the Harkness mine. So when your father married my Jean, he was almost a pauper. Good God, those shares would be worth £10 million today.
Well, that was during the Great Depression of the '30s. A lot of people lost money then.
We didn't. The Ballantines didn't.
Craig shrugged.
No, the Ballantines doubled up during the Depression.
We are winners, Jonathan repeated.
But what happens to you now? You know my rule. You don't get a penny more from me.
Yes, I know that rule, John John.
You want to try working here again?
It didn't pan out so well the last time, did it?
You're an impossible old bastard, said Craig fondly. I love you, but I'd rather work for Idi Amin than for you again.
Jonathan looked immensely pleased with himself. His image of himself as tough, ruthless, and ready to kill was another of his conceits. He would have been deeply insulted if anybody had called him easy-going or generous. The large anonymous donations he made to every charity, deserving or otherwise, were always accompanied by blood-curdling threats to anybody revealing his identity.
So what are you going to do with yourself this time?
Well, I was trained as an armourer when I did my national service, and there is an armourer's berth open in the police. The way I see it, I'm going to be called up again anyway, so I might as well beat them to it and enlist.
The police, Jonathan mused. That does have the virtue of being one of the few things you haven't tried yet. Get me another drink.
While Craig poured gin and tonic, Jonathan put on his fiercest expression to cover his embarrassment and
growled, Look here, boy. If you really are short, I'll bend the rule this once and lend you a few dollars to tide you over. Strictly alone, though, huh?
Oh, it's very decent of you, Bahu, but a rule is a rule.
I make 'em, I break 'em. Jonathan glared at him. How much do you need?
You know those old books you wanted? Craig murmured, as he put the old man's glass back in front of him, and an expression of intense cunning came into Jonathan's eyes, which he tried in vain to conceal.
What books?
His innocence was loaded.
Those old journals.
Oh, those! And despite himself, Jonathan glanced at the bookshelves beside his desk, upon which were displayed his collection of family journals. They stretched back over 100 years, from the arrival of his grandfather, Zuga Ballantyne, in Africa in 1860, up to the death of Jonathan's father, Sir Ralph Ballantyne, in 1929. But the sequence was broken by a few missing years. 3 volumes, which had come down on Craig's side of the family,
through old Harry Mellow, who had been Sir Ralph's partner and dearest friend. For some perverse reason that Craig could not even understand himself, he had up until now resisted all the old man's blandishments and attempts to get his hands on them. It was probably because they were the one small lever he had on Jonathan, that he had held out since they had come into his possession on his 21st birthday, the only item of any value in the inheritance from his long-dead father. "Yes, those," Craig nodded. "I thought I might let you have them." "You must be hard-pressed," the old man tried not to let his glee shine through. "Even more than usual," Craig admitted. "You waste? Okay, Barwoo, we've been that road before," Craig stopped him hurriedly. "Do you want them?" "How much?" Jonathan demanded suspiciously. "Well, last time you offered me 1,000 each. I must have been soft. Since then there's been 100% inflation." Jonathan loved to haggle. It enhanced his image of himself as hard and ruthless. Craig reckoned he was worth 10 million. He owned King's Lynn and 4 other ranches. He owned the Harkness Mine, which after 80 years in production was still producing 50,000 ounces of gold a year, and he had assets outside his beleaguered country, prudently stashed away over the years in Johannesburg, London, and New York. 10 million was probably conservative, Craig realized, and set himself to bargain as hard as the old man. At last they reached a figure, with Jonathan grumbling, "They're worth half of that." "There are 2 other conditions, Barwoo," and immediately Jonathan was suspicious again. "Number 1, you leave them to me in your will, the whole set, Zuga Ballantyne's and Sir Ralph's journals, all of them."
"Roland and Douglas,
they're going to get King's Lynn, and the Harkness, and all the rest. That's what you told me."
"Damn right," he growled. "They won't blow it all out the window like you would."
"Oh, they can have it," Craig grinned easily. "They're Ballantyne's, as you say. But I want the journals."
"What's your second condition?" Jonathan demanded.
"I want access to them now."
"What do you mean?"
"I want to be able to read and study any of them whenever I want to."
"Oh, what the hell, Craig? You've never given a damn about them before. I doubt you've even read the 3 you own."
"Oh, I've glanced through them," Craig admitted shamefacedly.
"And now?"
"Well, I was up at the Carmi Mission this morning in the old cemetery. There's a grave there, Victoria Mellow." Jonathan nodded.
"Auntie Vicky, Harry's wife. Go on."
"I had this strange feeling as I was standing there. Almost as though she was calling to me." Craig plucked at the thick forelock over his eyes and could not look at his grandfather. "And suddenly I wanted to find out more about her and the others." They were both silent for a while, and then Jonathan nodded.
"All right, my boy, I accept your conditions. Both sets will be yours one day, and until then you can read them whenever you wish to."
Jonathan had seldom been so pleased with a bargain. He had completed his sets after 30 years, and if the boy was serious about reading them, he had found a good home for them. The Lord knew neither Douglas nor Roland were interested, and in the meantime perhaps the journals might draw Craig back to King's Lynn more often. He wrote out the cheque and signed it with a flourish, while Craig went out to the Land Rover and dug the 3 leather-bound manuscripts from the bottom of his kit bag.
"I suppose you'll spend it all on that boat," Jonathan accused as he came in from the veranda.
"Some of it," Craig admitted. He placed the books in front of the old man.
"You're a dreamer." Jonathan slid the cheque across the desk.
"Sometimes I prefer dreams to reality." Craig scrutinized the figures briefly, then buttoned the pink cheque into his top pocket.
"That's your trouble," said Jonathan.
"Barwoo, if you start lecturing me, I'm going to head straight back to town." Jonathan held up both hands in capitulation.
"All right, all right," he chuckled.
"Your old room is the way you left it, if you want to use it." "I have an appointment with the police recruiting officer on Monday, but I'll stay the weekend, if that's okay."
"Well, I'll ring Trevor this evening and fix the interview."
Trevor Pennington was the Assistant Commissioner of Police. Jonathan believed in starting at the top. "I wish you wouldn't, John."
"Don't be daft," Jonathan snapped. "You must learn to use every advantage, my boy. That's the way life works."
Jonathan picked up the first of the three volumes of manuscript and gloatingly stroked it with his gnarled brown fingers.
"Now you can leave me alone for a while,"
he ordered, as he unfolded his wire-framed reading glasses and perched them on his nose.
"They're playing tennis across at Queen's Lynn. I'll see you back here for sundowners."
Craig glanced back from the doorway. But Jonathan Ballantyne was hunched over the book, transported by the entries in yellow, faded ink, back to his childhood. Although it shared a common 7-mile boundary with King's Lynn, Queen's Lynn was a separate ranch. Jonathan Ballantyne had added it to his holdings during the Great Depression of the 1930s, paying 5 cents on the dollar of its real worth. Now it formed the eastern spread of the Rowlands Ranching Company. It was the home of Jonathan's only surviving son, Douglas Ballantyne, and his wife Valerie. Douglas was the managing director of both Rowlands and the Harkness Mine. He was also Minister of Agriculture in Ian Smith's UDI government, and with any luck, he might be away on mysterious government or company business. Douglas Ballantyne had once given Craig his honest appraisal. "At heart you're a bloody hippie, Craig. You should get your hair cut and start bracing up. You can't go on dawdling through life and expecting Bawu and the rest of the family to carry you forever." Craig pulled a sour face at the memory as he drove down past the stockyards of Queen's Lynn and smelled the ammoniacal tang of cow dung. The huge Afrikander beasts were a uniform, deep chocolate red, the bulls humpbacked and with swinging dewlaps that almost brushed the earth. This breed had made Rhodesian beef almost as renowned as the marble beef of Kobe. As Minister of Agriculture, it was Douglas Ballantyne's duty to see that, despite sanctions, the world was not deprived of this delicacy. The route that it took to the tables of the great restaurants of the world was via Johannesburg and Cape Town, where it perforce changed its name. But the connoisseurs recognized it and asked for it by its nom de guerre, their taste buds probably piqued by the knowledge that they were eating forbidden fruits. Rhodesian tobacco and nickel and copper and gold all went out the same way, while petrol and diesel oil made the return trip. The popular bumper sticker said simply, "Thank you, South Africa." Beyond the stock pens and veterinary block, once again protected by the diamond mesh and barbed wire security fence, lay the green lawns and banks of flowering shrubs and the blazing Pride of India trees of the gardens of Queen's Lynn. The windows had been covered with grenade screens, and the servants would drop steel bulletproof shutters into their slots before sunset. But here the defences had not been built with the same gusto as Bawu had shown at King's Lynn. They fitted unobtrusively into the gracious surroundings. The lovely old house was very much as Craig remembered it from before the war, rosy red brick and wide, cool verandas. The jacaranda trees that lined the long, curved driveway were in full flower, like a mist bank of pale, ethereal blue, and there were at least 2 dozen cars parked beneath them, Mercedes and Jaguars, Cadillacs and BMWs, their paintwork hazed with the red dust of Matabele land. Craig concealed his venerable Land Rover behind the tumble of red and purple bougainvillea creeper, so as not to lower the tone of a Queen's Lynn Saturday. From habit, he slung an FN rifle over his shoulder and wandered around the side of the house. From ahead there came the sound of children's voices, gay as songbirds, and the genial scolding of their black nannies, punctuated by the sharp pock, pock of a long rally from the tennis courts. Craig paused at the head of the terraced lawns. Children spilled and tumbled and chased each other in circles like puppies over the green grass. Nearer the yellow clay courts, their parents sprawled on spread rugs or sat at the shaded white tea tables under the brightly coloured umbrellas. They were bronzed young men and women in tennis whites, sipping tea or drinking beer from tall frosted glasses, calling ribald comment and advice to the players upon the courts. The only incongruous note was the row of machine pistols and automatic rifles beside the silver tea set and cream scones. Someone recognized Craig and shouted, "Hi, Craig, long time no see," and others waved. But there was just that faint edge of condescension in their manner, reserved for the poor relative. These were the families with great estates, a closed club of the wealthy in which, for all their geniality, Craig would never have full membership.